Hello and welcome back to The Great Game, an Australian mega game podcast. I'm Jack.
And I'm Patrick.
And in this episode, we're speaking with Leon and Ben from Melbourne Mega Games Crisis in Elysium, which ran in November 2022.
Crisis was my first mega game sort of coming back out of the pandemic. And it was probably the first one I've actually played in for a good 4 or 5 years, I think. Probably since Wellington when I would play Den of Wolves. So I just wanted to point out right up front, thanks to Melbourne Mega Games for having us. It was an absolute ball. Also, we may have gone into this episode a little bit rusty and maybe got a bit excited and may have skipped over talking too much about what the game is actually about at the start. So I just wanted to quickly give an overview of Crisis in Elysium before we jump in. The game is set in the 22nd century Mars. Mars has been colonized for 50 years, and it's a home to a whole bunch of people. And the first attempts at terraforming are underway, and, you know, it's a bright new future kind of set up. But, of course, Mars is on the brink of civil war, and there's a lot of factions with different ideologies playing out their visions there. And everything that's been achieved could soon be lost. So, yeah, in a nutshell, Elysium was about politics and intrigue and subterfuge and more politics. And it was all sort of wrapped up in a sci-fi, cyberpunk kind of future wrapping. But really, it was a classic mega game with a whole bunch of map action. So I hope you enjoy hearing us talk about it. Before we jump in, though, Jack, any mega game news or events that are worth shouting out?
Absolutely. So it's awesome to see everyone kind of getting back into the swing of things, including us. So in January, there is another run of Crisis in Elysium, which is sadly sold out from Melbourne Mega Games. But we do advise you to check out the Melbourne Mega Games Facebook page for future games this year.
Yes, I do have an inkling that there will be more coming in Melbourne this year. Likewise, in Sydney, we have just confirmed the date of our first mega game for many years, I think 3 years, I think, or maybe four. Mm. So we will be having our first game on the 6th of May, Saturday the 6th of May here in Sydney. More info is coming soon, so keep an eye on the social media and our website, Sydney Mega Gamers.
Yes, and if you're looking for more Mega Games, check out the Mega Gamer calendar at megagameassembly.com for a bunch of super awesome stuff that's happening in 2023, including First Contact London, which looks pretty huge and exciting. So tons of stuff happening there.
Without further ado then, I suggest we get on with the episode. I hope you enjoy. And this is us talking with Ben and Leon about Crisis in Elysium. Thank you both, all, I suppose, for joining us. Today we are talking about Crisis in Elysium, which three of the four of us present here attended a few weeks back. It actually feels a very long time ago at this point, but I think that's just how this year's going. Before we jumped in, we've got lots to talk about, keen to dig into the game itself, how it ran, and you know, some of the design stuff as well. But before we get into it, I thought we'd best run around at least with Jeff and Leon, and talk about who we are, where we've come from. So just as a bit of an overview, since I'm playing the role of an interviewee this time around, I might just quickly summarize myself. I'm Patrick. I was a member of the One Humanity team in Crisis in Elysium, which I'll get into a bit later about what that means. My role was Brigade Commander, but on the day I decided to relabel myself as Community Resilience Officer. But essentially, I was at the war map doing war things. My mega game background is that I run the Sydney Mega Gamers, been designing and running mega games up there since whenever Shut Up, Sit Down did that video, 2014, I think it is. And how did I get involved in this? I was just desperate to go and get involved in a live mega game again after the years that have just gone by. And so, spur of the moment, I got a ticket down to Melbourne and was lucky enough to join a really awesome team. So, Leon.
So, I'm Leon. I was faction control in Crisis in Elysium for Green Mars, the Church of the True Martian, and a few other fun factions. My main game background and how I got involved in this game are pretty similar. So I've been involved in running games with Melbourne Mega Games, either as control or as part of the core logistics team producing games, or as a designer designing games from scratch or revising games for the last few years. And that's pretty much how I ended up involved in Crysis.
And is it correct that you've designed one game that's gone live with Up the Arc?
Yeah, correct. Okay. The Arc was my first game. We ran it last year twice.
Okay. And Jeff?
G'day, my name is Jeff. I live in Melbourne. Mega game background. Well, I'd never done anything like that before. I was looking around on the internet for some things to do. I just moved to Melbourne and, you know, just looking to get out there. And I found the concept of mega games while I was looking around at various role play things and thought, geez, that sounds really great. So on the day I played the console, which was the head of the Greater Republic of China, I got to run all around all day causing havoc. It was absolutely fantastic. Do it again.
Excellent. And it's interesting that you say you just happened to sort of search around and find this. Am I correct in assuming then that you didn't come into Mega Games through seeing the video by Shut Up and Sit Down?
Well, that wasn't my first exposure, no. Oh, yeah. So I was trying to figure out things I could do to like meet people in town, and I've done role-playing in the past, and I thought, oh, wouldn't LARPing be interesting? So I looked at a whole lot of LARPing stuff and just floating around. I came across this mega game concept and then came onto the YouTube video, and that just made it look so much fun. I had to do it.
Yeah, it really kicked off a global movement, I think, that video. Yeah. It's definitely how we all got into it. And I think you're a bit of a unicorn stumbling into it without, you know, finding that video first. So that's a first on this podcast, at least, and on the podcast I've listened to. Okay, so I might at this point throw things over to Jack to lead us through this debrief, as I was there on the ground. I've got my biases and my strong opinions, and I might leave it to Jack to take the reins.
Absolutely. Yeah, so I was very jealous of the game that I couldn't attend. But so I'll start out by asking, what is Crysis and Elysium? What is the mega game about?
And I think you might get three different answers.
Yeah. let's go for Leon first as a control member.
Mm-hmm. So I think like my way of thinking about Crysis and Elysium is, if you've ever seen The Expanse, it's like Mars in The Expanse, but wind back 50 years from that, the world of the show and the books. So it's a very like political game about a Martian colony, and it's basically about I'd say the gradual trend towards disorder on this colony, the gradual and inevitable trend towards disorder.
Nice. I think a lot of mega games are about the gradual trend towards disorder. I think that's a good fit for that theme.
I like that description, and I think there was a conversation either in the Discord or maybe at the pub afterwards about how there seems to be two types of games, one where there's like a predefined outcome and one where the outcome is you lose and it's just about that downhill spiral. I don't know who said that, but it did feel a little bit like that, Leon, once we got our heads around what was going on, at least from my perspective. Jeff, first time mega gamer, what do you think Crysis and Elysium was about?
Crysis and Elysium felt to me like the real world squeezed into a fishbowl. Like it didn't really... I mean, I get that there was a sci-fi setting and stuff. It just felt scary real, to tell you the truth. Once I got into the thick of it, into my role, I really... really felt like a certain type of compassion and like brotherhood with the people that... that play that role in the real world, you know. It just, I don't know, it just felt like all the most hyperbolic characters we presently have in a small space.
Wow, that's fantastic. So speaking about that, let's start talking about people's roles. What was your role, Jeff, and what kind of mechanics were you most involved in on the day?
So it was the console of Greater Republic of China. I was kind of the political head of one of the major powerful factions that was trying to seize a little slice of Elysium. Well, I think the other teams were trying to seize a little slice. I wanted the whole damn thing all to myself. And so I spent the day, you know, really kind of just freewheeling and doing whatever I wanted without much contact with the board or anything like that. It was just all about trying to talk people into doing what I wanted and looking at their incredulous little faces as I made ridiculous proposals.
It's fantastic. Like you're a natural. it's funny too, because I'm not interacting with your team much. My summary to Jack in the brief notes I wrote up was that China wants Mars to be China too. And I think that sounds like it was pretty accurate.
Oh, absolutely. I think it was just so well written, and just the mechanics were so good at the end for like getting us into that role, you know. I think even at first I was a little frustrated that everyone kind of knew how downright like power hungry we were going to be because the gig was up. But it just pushed me into the role of villain because I couldn't do anything else. And it just flowed so naturally. It wasn't even so much in the end. I didn't feel like we wanted, I mean, I knew what China wanted and I knew how it would generally function, but I just felt compelled to go down a certain pathway due to like the other options that were closed off to me. It wasn't even like I wanted anything. I just had to act in a certain way.
Interesting. Cool.
That's the inevitability part.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome. And Patrick, what was your role and what mechanics were you most involved in?
Yeah, so I decided to challenge myself with this game. I've designed mega games before, including the map side of things and the operational side, and I've never played it. So I put myself in a map role, which is not my usual forte. Usually I'm the wheeler and dealer. So One Humanity, we were a group who wanted things never to change on Mars. We were very happy with the way it was. We were supporters of the upper class, but we called ourselves the middle. And in the chat that we had on Discord with my team before the game, we kind of realized we were kind of like the Proud Boys, the kind of militant, social, angsty kind of people who were not happy for anything to change, which was kind of topical and confronting, but also, you know, there's a lot of opportunity there for role play stuff. So we kind of got into it. But yeah, our brief basically told us we don't want migration to Mars. We don't want it to change. We want to support the government there, which nobody else seems to like. We want to work with the police force be agitators whenever things look like they might be changing, you know, if there's social freedoms coming in or the governments from Earth are getting too much control, where to go and, to cause chaos. And so my role as one of the map players was to do just that on one of the maps, the Western Dome, I think it was. And so I had a role of placing units and taking control of areas and quite a complex map game.
Interesting. Awesome. And how did you find those kind of political themes played out on the day then? The restriction of immigration to Mars, that side of things.
I knew what we were fighting for, but when it came to fighting for it, I was pretty rampant. I was doing all kinds of stuff and just going to the rest of my team saying, listen, I need some stuff to make dirty bombs. And I was pretty removed from the politics. And it's funny, one thing that I found interesting with the political themes was teams clearly had agendas and stances on the major issues facing Mars, but the individuals on those teams either didn't hold those values too strongly or they had their own. And so my interactions with some people around my map, like the Americans at first, Green Mars was a difficult one. I think they were meant to be my friend, but I never got along with them. Those relationships didn't necessarily map to what was happening in the political world. So that became really interesting, where I would have conversations sometimes with my team saying, I've got the Americans on side, we're going to do this and that. Another team that was present at my map, and that wouldn't really ring true with what had just happened in the council, which is like a classic mega game pitfall, I suppose. But it was interesting. It made these little microcosms. And near the end of the game, I felt like the maps were each, like there were three maps in this game representing three different major colonies or parts of the city. And I felt like each of those was kind of in conflict with each other to survive. Mm. that was my perspective anyway. I think I was in a little bubble.
Yeah, I would say as control, like the most, where the rubber really hit the road in terms of like player objectives and how that got realized through play, I feel like my observations over the course of the day were that it was most noticeable when the objectives were something like control XYZ ward on this map. So, for example, FSI, one of the government factions, had an objective to control a spaceport, and they spent like 4 or 5 rounds just devoting almost all of their resources to fighting for control of that spaceport again and again and again and again. And that was really like thematically strong and well realized through play. But there were a lot of other objectives like immigration and terraforming, which, because they just sort of sat as global trackers off to the side and they didn't have, they weren't really acted upon very strongly in the main space of the game, which is the map. They kind of fell by the wayside, I felt.
Right, that makes sense. So you found the most powerful objectives, or the ones that seemed to be the most resonant, were the ones that were very specific like that, like control this specific region.
Yeah. And it was also, it was quite interesting what you mentioned, Pat, around some of the factions not internalizing the objectives they were sent in their briefs. That was something that was really noticeable to control. At about round 3 or 4, most of us were sitting around a table during the lunch break thinking about what, if anything, we would do about that situation. Because we were noticing that there were some teams that were supposed to be in strong conflict with each other that were not really in strong conflict with each other.
Yes.
But that spawned just some very interesting experiences for faction control, because I got to go off and go up to the US team and just pull their leader aside and say, oh, you know, you're getting a phone call, and you pick up the phone and then you realize it's actually the red phone and it's the president. And the president is telling you that you have to go attack these people.
Yeah, it was interesting. Like, it might be something we can dig into later in more depth, but the having the briefings really specify strong stances on issues and give like really direct, stances and relationships with other teams. That's always a difficult thing in games. And I've found over the years in my design work, I've started like pulling back from that and making briefings a bit more tactile and a bit briefer and less specific. Because if you write this grand opera and then people don't stick to their roles, you do end up having that moment where you sit around the table wondering if you need to do something about it.
I've definitely had the exact same thing. Like, for example, where two nations are meant to be fighting over this place and they're like, well, we don't actually care about this place, why don't we just share it? Or things like that happen where people tend to take the briefs a lot of the time and go a completely different direction with it, or don't stick to those goals. But that can be a lot of really interesting in itself, I think.
Yeah, it's the space for emergent gameplay, right?
Yes. Absolutely.
And I think that was my team's experience. We had basically a really clear pact with the Martian government, the Martian Colonial Authority, I think they were, the MCA. And so everything that we planned to do was to support them, prop them up, make them look good, make sure they hold power. And very early in the game, that team was like, well, we're going to kind of merge with other teams and we're going to do this and that, and we're going to change our agenda. And it left us feeling a bit unsure about what we should do. And we sort of started leaning towards anarchy because we saw, you know, this as a betrayal in the game. Partially, maybe it was because of players going against their briefs, but also we learned in the debrief, there were a lot of people on that team who had underlying, you know, things that went against their team. Like, they were sort of set up to fracture, it looks like. So that made it difficult for us to understand where we sat in things, but I think we still, you know, came out with a pretty good narrative at the end. It's always just hard, I think, when there's really specific narratives written and you need 50, 60 people to all adhere to it and understand the history and follow the briefs to the letter.
Absolutely. Awesome. Well, what stuck out to you as something that was unique or special or surprising about this game?
Oh, God. I don't know if I've got an answer. I think having the 3 maps was unique. I can't, I'm not sure yet if I like it.
That's fair.
But it was, it very much made the game, in my eyes, about the maps. That was everything centered around the operational stuff in one way or another, which can be a good thing. And it was quite a bold move having three maps that kind of interacted, but not 100%, and were their own sort of mini theaters of war. I found that quite interesting. I don't think I've played a game like that before. I'm still unpacking exactly whether or not I think it works or whether or not it was executed the right way.
Interesting.
It was unique. It's good to experience.
And Leon, from a control perspective, how did you find those three maps?
It was a very interesting experience from a control point of view, particularly in the context of some of the games we've run previously. It was very, they were well designed. They worked quite well. I have some views about things that I would change, but for the most part, they were very well designed. But the downside to them was that whenever I had a player come up to me wanting to do a cool thing, the answer in Crisis is almost always some version of you need to do ABC at a map. It's you need to get this special action card that simulates what you're talking about and do it at this particular location on a map. And the challenge with that is that a lot of the players coming up to me with those cool ideas are players that were not super interested in the crunchy war game mechanic of the map. So there was some dissonance, I think, in that. But otherwise, I think they worked quite well. Like, as far as maps go in Mega games that I've seen previously, it was very effective, and a lot of them captured the like intensity and mechanical ideas they were trying to express.
Yeah, cool. And Jeff, you know, first Mega game, what stuck out to you as maybe something that was surprising or that you didn't expect going in?
Oh, well, you know, I'd watched a bit about it before I went in. I watched a few games. There wasn't too much that was terribly surprising. I think the degree of emergent gameplay, I was very impressed. I'd never seen anything quite as emergent as that. And I think the multiple maps was an absolutely fabulous addition. From being like the leader of my team and watching the team, the members that were like the tactical components of my team get the opportunity to kind of work a little bit autonomous to each other without oversight, and that just drove more emergence. Like in my team, people had like slight misunderstandings of what they were supposed to be doing on the map, which resulted in things that I had to in turn respond to, which dictated things that happened on the geopolitical frame scale of the game. I think that was absolutely brilliant. So it was how successfully you guys managed to capture an emergent game is what really surprised me, because I've seen a lot of people try and I've never seen anything quite like that.
Wonderful, yeah. But so good. Yeah. Sorry, Leah.
No, I was just going to say, Mega games are generally quite good at that. I think it's a feature of Crisis, but it's also a feature of every Mega game that I've played previously.
Yeah. And I was going to say, just on that point, when we were going into this and I was talking with my team about roles, so with this game, a lot of Mega games that I've run in Sydney and others that I've been to, you sign up and you either buy a ticket for a specific role or you choose the role in advance some other way. Or, you know, in some of my games, there weren't roles. In this one, we bought tickets, we were then placed on teams, and then the teams, in my experience anyway, we then had to decide who was going to be what role in our team. So when we were having a conversation about that online beforehand, I was getting a bit concerned that these teams were quite large. Usually I've run games with teams of four or three. I have run some games that had a few large teams. In this case, it was six people. And I looked at it and thought, okay, there's three people looking at the maps. What are the other three doing? One goes to the council. Okay. And like, it all sort of started to make sense to me on paper, but I was still concerned that there was maybe too many people on each team. On the day, I think our leader, Phil, started to feel a little bit of that in the early game where he wasn't really sure what he was meant to be doing when all the map action was happening, because the majority of players in the game were huddled around maps or around the council table. and all that was left were leaders. And if you weren't having a conversation with them, you were kind of twiddling your thumbs. There wasn't any background to do, which is, it happens in a lot of games with a lot of roles. But I think, to what Jeff said, by mid early game, like turn 3-4, everyone sort of hit their stride. And I feel like the number of roles and the delineation of duties in the teams made a lot of sense, and it worked really well. It seemed quite balanced. No one was bored, in my experience anyway, and no one ever felt like they had too much responsibility. So I think that was quite a good thing.
Awesome. So what stuck out as some of your favorite moments from the game?
Well, I think, like I said, my interactions were on the map. Early on, I realized that if we're fighting on the map against multiple other teams or against forces that are from the Earth governments, we don't really stand much of a chance with our resources, small amount of resources and the strength of them. So early on, I engaged with the, there was a single faction in the game that were basically mercenaries. And I think the best moments I had in the game was dealing with them. First learning my lesson that if I paid them minimum wage, they were probably going to call me out at the map and make it clear that I was the one who hired them to do things. So I learned that lesson, paid them a bit more later on, and then had a lot of interactions with them organizing sort of false flags, actions that were actually against me as well as other teams to sort of cause chaos and ensure that, you know, there was a territory that I was vying for against another team. And I basically took the stance, if we can't have it, no one can. So I had the mercenary company come in and really ruin it. Those interactions were really good. It was very clandestine. The team, the mercs were very fun role players. Had a good, yeah, I think any interaction with them was the highlights of my day.
Awesome. How about you, Jeff?
Oh, well, I think my highlight of the day was probably about halfway through the game, maybe a little bit more, when we'd all kind of figured out what our roles were and what we all thought of each other. And the FSI, who are the Indian kind of mega corporation, they came to me and they said, "Oh, Console, we're gonna try to kick out the Mars government. You know, we're gonna vote, well, the Mars governor. We're gonna vote no confidence. Would you just quietly kind of back me up with that?" And, you know, I could see the concern in his eyes that he was asking me for help, because no one really wanted to work with me at that stage. I thought, this is brilliant. So we went to the meeting and we all sat down, and the FSI says, "I'd like to raise a motion of no confidence in the governor." And he sat there silently trying not to look at me. And I leaned across the table and I said, "I would like to support my esteemed ally, the FSI, in down, overthrowing this corrupt government." And his jaw just dropped and he was shocked. You know, just like soiled him in front of everyone. It was just amazing. And I just tasted blood in the water. And so this guy looks shy. He's like, "What are you talking about? What are you talking about? You wanted this anyway." I'm like, "Oh, what? What? Are you turning your back on our alliance now?" And he hated it. And it was so much fun. And so when the notion got passed, I realized there's more fun to be had. So when nominations came about, I leaned forward and I said, "In alliance with our current agreements, I'd like to nominate the esteemed head of the EU as the new governor."
I remember this.
I had no idea that was coming. And he's trying to both accept, reject, look innocent, deny, while the FSI guy is looking betrayed, trying to act like there was no betrayal. And I think the council only lasted about two more sessions after that.
Beautiful.
It was so good.
Oh, I love it.
Oh, that's wonderful. How about yourself, Leon?
I think my favorite moments were generally the opportunities that I got to roleplay characters as faction control. And in particular, I think my favorite experience was the story of Dr. Gerhardt, who was a civilian scientist that I invented, who would go off and be like paid to make authoritative statements about this, that, or the other scientific research that whoever would want to propose. And at the end, towards the end, the political control, Peter, he tapped me on the shoulder and he's like, "I think we should just have Dr. Gerhardt make an appearance at the council." And I'm like, "Is there anything you want me to talk about in particular?" And he's like, no, just make an appearance and say something interesting. And I rock up and I can't remember exactly what I said. But one of the people on the council finally challenged me and they're like, hang on, haven't you taken like four positions over the course of this game? Like who even, you know, is funding you? And where do you get your research money? And it basically came out that Dr. Gerhardt was a scientist for hire. And it was just very fun being able to play him talking to the Church of the True Martians about the various things that they have found, and then talking to Green Mars about the value of terraforming, and talking to other people about no, your chemical bomb won't be that damaging. just doing all sorts of other, like every scientific point of view, he was just whatever was most chaotic is his answer.
Love it.
And whatever pays him the most money.
I feel like there was so much missed at the council, so much, so many stories out of there. I might just summarize, actually. Usually in these kind of debriefs, we talk a lot about the narrative. There's so much that happened on the day. I don't know if we could accurately retell it. Likewise, there's probably some spoilers hidden in there for people who are going to play it again, either in Melbourne or elsewhere. But I think it's fair to say that there was a lot of chaos. There were nukes eventually used. Refugee camps were destroyed. Really terrible sort of crosses, you know, betrayals. The council kept getting eliminated or targeted. There was, you know, democracy was going out the window. And the game did end, which is sort of goes back to that comment from Leon at the start about the downward spiral. The game did inevitably end with the civil war on Mars and everyone basically withdrawing because it was all ruined. So, it's no surprise, really, looking back at the interactions we had. There were only a few times I talked to other teams where I felt like we were making a positive move. It was nearly always subterfuge and, evil stuff in the shadows. I'm not sure if that's how it came across from the national side, Jeff, but I think we all saw it going that direction.
I mean, I just saw it as pure chaos. I think the unusual thing I saw going on at the top political level was people's like bipolar approach to like appeasement and aggression. It's just people didn't seem to have any middle gear at all day. You know, they were either I saw Red Mars, which was the most aggressive, they seemed to be the most aggressive radical party that wanted to overthrow everything, vote in favor of funding the police more.
Yeah. It was quite funny because they were in favor of funding the police more at the same time that the other half of their team was kidnapping the governor and then blowing themselves up with the governor.
So take me through how that the ending went then, the chaos and the resolution. Was there a final moment where everyone kind of went through the final story for their teams as Mars descended into chaos? Like how did you run that?
Well, I think I'll let Leon answer from the control side, but my understanding as a player was it was always said in the book that if every map reached a certain level of instability, then civil war broke out and the game was over. And Control did stand up at one point at the end after a whole bunch of shenanigans and explained that's what had happened. And narratively, Mars was left to sort of crumble on its own, and the Earth nations left and sort of gave up on the experiment. But I'm not sure, Leon, if there's more nuance to that.
Yeah, so there are some hard rules in the book around when the game ends, when all the maps reach a certain level of instability. A couple of the maps reach that level, but in particular, one thing that was quite funny is that all of the connection points between the maps were destroyed. So there was no way of traveling around Mars. And then what we tried to do at the end as Control was to basically get up and say, the Earth's governments have abandoned Mars to the Martians. And I think that got misinterpreted a little bit as the Earth's governments have abandoned Mars to die in ruin, but it was more kind of like all of the radical groups have collectively achieved their objective of being so disorderly that all semblance of order has just decided we can't be stuffed trying to deal with this.
Right.
that was kind of the intent of that closing spiel.
Yeah, right. So a crisis in Elysium 2 would just be all the radical groups fighting a civil war until one of them reigns supreme, basically.
Yeah, well, it's quite funny, actually. Some of the radical groups do actually have objectives related to forming common ground with other radical groups. Because in the game's narrative, a lot of the radical groups come from a common starting point around the Martian independence movement, and then they all sort of fracture. It's the classic, we want to be independent from Earth, but we all kind of have different views of what independence means story.
Yeah.
And some of the factions, the radical factions, actually have explicit objectives related to finding common ground with other radical groups.
Right.
Interesting. Let's dive a bit deeper in terms of any gripes or any things that you think stood out as potential issues on the day.
Well, I've got plenty as a designer. I'm like, not gripes or critical, you know, hardcore critiques, but things that I would like to see changed or experiment with. But the one thing I'll call out, because I got to experience it firsthand, was the death mechanics. I got to experience that as a player assassinating another player, like Leon alluded to, with a card that I had to find. And then also I myself was killed, not necessarily assassinated, but rather sacrificed by the Church of the Real Martians, the True Martians. I don't know why that happened. They must have found out about me attacking the church district. But the mechanics there, and Leon might be able to talk more about these. I think we had a chat on the day. The mechanics there were that I was removed from the game for a short period of time, and I received the one pager that kind of gave me a bit of an idea of who my new character was. And I returned to my team, still in the same role, but with new objectives. And it's at that point, which was almost like the last turn of the game, that I was this new character that I had to take on was actually a traitor to the team and was helping Jeff's team, the Chinese team. Had been feeding them information and resources, and now had to try to get on board with them, reveal myself to them, and get sort of asylum with them, which was interesting. It would have been fun to have done, you know, a few turns earlier, I guess. The timing was poor for me. But just generally, that experience was fine, I suppose, as far as death mechanics go. My experience of assassinating another character was really uninspired. We just had someone removed from the game for a short time. Presumably the same thing happened to them, but it didn't really have any impact on the game otherwise. I think in one of the maps, one of the commanders of a team was assassinated in the hopes that that would mean that team wouldn't get to act that turn, but they did anyway. So there was no seeming mechanical advantage to using this powerful card. So I guess it goes back to the narrative and the emergent gameplay and the story, which, yes, it made an interesting story, but it was strange combining the rigid need to find a special card and a special mechanic to do this thing, and then there's no mechanical payoff for it. So that's one thing I'd be keen to have, you know, explored and maybe built out a little bit if death's going to be part of the game.
Interesting. And Leon, did you have the same feelings about that mechanic? Is there a way that you would want to change it if you did end up running a second run?
So, I mean, we're not actually able to change any of the game's rules going into the second game. That's part of the agreement to be able to run the game. We can change some things about our execution. I think the example that you gave, Pat, around the map is an example I heard a couple of times, which is probably an execution example.
Right.
But I think I generally share your view that player death was pretty ordinary. And I think this is my personal opinion, is that player death is pretty ordinary in basically every game that I've ever seen player death.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not very interesting to me. And I don't think most players who get into their role and sort of, as Jeff was saying earlier, they really like that you start to feel very like deep in that role. You don't really want that character to die. And if they do die, it's really hard to extricate yourself from being so deep in that role. So you kind of just end up creating their identical twin, which makes it kind of narratively meaningless. So from that point of view, I've yet to see any game, and this doesn't just, it's not just mega games, but I've really yet to see any game do player death super well, especially in conjunction with trying to tell a character-driven story. So I probably would just remove that mechanic, excepting in exceptional circumstances like kidnapping the governor and blowing up the building that they're in.
Yeah, I think that's very reasonable. Interesting. How about you, Jeff? Is there any elements of the game that you thought didn't go as well or could have been improved?
Well, I think I found it rather difficult to work with control to make like bespoke movements and actions. I had a lot of freedom in like the political realm to make agreements. But unfortunately, working with control to try and come up with, like you were saying earlier, like usually the answer for, oh, can I do this thing was wait for a card, you know? And I guess that's fine. I'm not sure how you could possibly control a game on that scale if everyone's just making it up as they go along. But I feel like I wasn't in the end aware of how to actually have those negotiations. Didn't see any framework around how to do that. Me, player death was a really different experience. I actually didn't get one of those sheets. When the council got blown up and everyone died, they all got a special character sheet except for me. Well, I just imagined myself as the immortal god emperor of China and play the same character. So I actually got the experience of like not having to really have a character die. It did make it somewhat meaningless, aside from the fact I had to go for a 5-minute walk. But returning the same character was just absolutely fine. Although I did see, talking to people after the game, I did see how that the injection of like traitor or like divergent objectives on people who had died creates a strong disincentive like to allow your character to die, which I think would have been nice to know about beforehand. I think people didn't so much, they didn't know that there was a huge disincentive for their character dying. That it would work against their team so strongly. I think that might have changed some of the behavior. I think people might have been a bit more cautious about having their characters die. At one stage, there was quite obviously a complete lack of security around the council. The council simply was doing nothing about it. I was certainly trying to make some proposals that would play in my favor. We did nothing about it. And that's kind of invariably what resulted in the council being destroyed, which kind of was a bit of an immersion breaking moment for me, like watching a whole lot of people around the table, supposedly in a council building surrounded by vacuum, not so much worrying about terrorists surrounding them.
I'd say on the negotiating with control to do interesting things. So, It's written in the control guidebook for this game that the majority of crazy player ideas are covered by cards, and that you should try and use cards as a way to like adjacently execute other ideas that aren't explicitly covered by cards. I don't find that super satisfying. The way that I did that in the arc, which I think worked fairly well, is in the arc, players and teams had specific objectives that were like quite defined. And when you completed those objectives, you got a little faction token. And then you could use that faction token to go do any random cool thing that you wanted to do. So you had to achieve a goal, and then you got given a resource, and you could spend the resource to do another cool thing. Ooh. So it created this kind of snowballing completion of goals. Which ended up being quite an effective way of providing a resource gate that had you had to achieve something in the narrative to be able to go through that gate.
Yeah, that does sound interesting. And I think, as you were saying, Jeff, this being your first game and the idea that anyone can just do anything is probably chaos. It definitely is, and a lot of mega games allow that. I guess, to obligatorily mention Watch the Skies, it's got that mechanic in it, and notoriously featured in the Shut Up Sit Down video, where they have that realization that they can kind of do whatever they want, and it's just a roll of a die, and someone decides off on a whim, yeah, you succeeded in assassinating someone or kidnapping someone, or you didn't. And I think that, like, having heard this discussion now, maybe Alex, who designed this Crisis in Elysium, was trying to figure out a way to swing that pendulum back hard to the more rigid side and make this a more rigid mechanical design. Because it sounds like that's what they've tried to do, address that issue, and maybe it's gone too far.
I think it is. It is very easy for things to, if it is too easy to make up unique, crazy ideas off the top of your head, then a lot of it starts. It can stop feeling real. It can, like, just feel like everything is freewheeling. So I think, like, it is really good to have some control over it, or some, like, yeah, similar to a card situation. But I think that's a really...
Yeah. Yeah, it swings the opposite way. The cards make it too difficult, like too rigid to do. And but then being able to do anything anytime if you just have resources makes it almost pointless in doing those things, because anyone can at any time. It's a hard balance.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think this is a good point to bring up that maybe we should have done earlier, is that this mega game was obviously designed by Alex Beck, who is the designer behind Den of Wolves and a lot of other great projects, and a really big fixture of the UK mega game scene. And I think obviously the game was super successful for you guys. It seems like everyone had an awesome time, but I was wondering if you can talk about how that process went, what triggered you for the idea of getting this mega game from Alex, and
so we generally try to pick games by theme or genre. So we really wanted to run something in a sort of sci-fi space. And we'd, as you said, Alex is very well known. We'd heard quite good things about the design of his games. And I think probably very well earned things about the high quality design. We initially looked at two games of his, Crisis and Mirror Shades, which is a more sort of cyberpunk, you're all kind of in one city type game. But we basically just reached out. We said we wanted to play Crisis. It was quite a straightforward production process. We got all the materials in soft copy. It was there was quite clear instructions about how to manufacture things. It was relatively straightforward to do. And Alex was quite responsive to some of the questions that we asked him. We did have to clarify a few things, particularly about how the initiative system works at the map, but yeah, very responsive and generally like a very positive experience overall. But yeah, as I said, we try and pick games on theme, so we find that sci-fi works quite well, and we just wanted to try something that was kind of a very high quality classical mega game. Is kind of what we had in our head, and I think that was basically what we got.
Yeah, wonderful, awesome. And would you recommend the same process to other people if they're interested in running something like this?
Yeah, the mega games community is super super open and friendly, and we've had nothing but positive experiences with basically any designer we've reached out to about any game, yourselves included. I've got a plug, yeah, it's a very positive community. Sometimes we'll get responses back from designers that are kind of like, oh, I would like to revise my game a little bit before I market it. But generally, everyone's really happy to see the hobby grow. So, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, I think a lot of designs are a bit more in the... Mega Game Assembly has a lot of pre-made mega games that are up on their site. And then there are a lot of designs that are best to reach out to the designer for if anyone's listening and interested in checking those out. Awesome. I'll just run around the table. I think we've talked a lot about the design or thing like that. Is there anything from this game that you would like to see in more Mega games, or just anything in general that you would like to see carried on, or that would impact you, or that you would love to see more of?
For me, jumping into the map game, I did, like I said, I deliberately did that to get that experience, and it taught me a lot about what the operational mappy players go through. I really liked, so the map game, without going into too much detail, it was semi-blind. So the radical teams who lived on Mars and were the natives and had all these extreme political agendas, when they placed units on the map team, they did so blindly, so no one else could see what they were. And the other teams, the national teams, needed to either use an action to reveal those units using a surveillance action. I think narratively they sent out drones into the wards and tried to find out what was going on. And otherwise they didn't know what was under those little unit tokens until they were flipped up. And the RADs had the ability to place down diversions so that they were basically blank tokens that got placed out on the map. No one knew what they were until action started. I really liked that blind map mechanic. It was something I learned about not long ago, and I'm really keen to try it out in a game that I'm working on. So it was really good for me to experience that, and I think I'd like to see more of that, like innovative map mechanics, whether it's blind or otherwise, just changing up how that map action works, and it's not just units being placed and dice being rolled or cards being drawn, but getting a bit more creative there. So that was a good inspiration for me.
Awesome. Jeff, I know this is your first Mega game. Is there anything from this game that you are excited to see in future, or that you are keen for in your future Mega gaming exploits?
Well, I'm just keen to try a lot more out and do a lot more games. I don't know precisely what I want to change. I'm sure as a new player, everything I'd like to see has probably got its pros and cons that have been well thought out. Of course, you know, the game, even though it went for so long, ended up feeling like it ended too early. there just wasn't enough time to do everything, but I'm sure that frenetic pace has its reasons. I would like to have seen the prestige items given a little bit more gravitas in some way. There were really attractive like role playing components of the game that I feel like just somehow didn't like draw the attention that that it deserved, or you know, like get the role play opportunities that could have been interesting with it. At least from my perspective.
Yeah, I with the prestige, if I'm thinking about the right things, I did not interact with the prestige items or give them a single thought until the last turn when, Jeff, you actually gave me one, I think, or someone in your team did.
Yeah, well, I did, yeah.
I was like, so I'm a trader. I want to join you. Help me. And he gave me a little cube, and it's like, welcome aboard, comrade. and that was literally the moment I remembered, oh, there's this prestige thing in this game, and yeah, it didn't come front of mind at all for me.
Yeah, unfortunately I find with those kinds of things, unless they have a function, it's really hard to give them value. And if they're just a bauble that you buy, it's quite hard to turn that into value, because you're relying purely on the story to do that, and in the chaos of a Mega game, that's challenging.
Yeah, I think that was when I was reading it in the rules, I did assume, okay, so there's going to be a player somewhere who in their brief it says you want to get prestige items, and that'll be their little arc, and that's kind of it. The best, on that point, I remember that I've had games in the past. In Sydney, we ran this pirate game, and it was chaos. It was called Chaos on the INC, actually. But it was really chaotic, and it was the biggest game we've run, and I would never do it again. But in that, there was, you can only imagine the kind of costumes and stuff that came out in that one. And there was this whole narrative that happened in the background where someone's plastic sword that they brought had this legend about it, and it started to spread throughout the game, and people were coveting it, and all this stuff happened that I had no idea about. And I feel like that's what you want to happen with the prestige little items. Like, you want the players to, you want to hope that they fall into some emergent storyline in the background, and even if it's not tied into the game's design, people get enjoyment from it. But I just don't know.
I remember that plastic sword very clearly. I think we our team, when I was in Chaos in the INC, our team had it at one point, and we're like, yes, the sword. And I think I think just having it be a cool looking plastic sword was probably really helpful enough, for that.
Yeah.
I think the thing that I would really like to see in other games is the quality of the resourcing and the game economy in Crysis was by far and away the best that I've seen in any game. It was traditionally in mega games, my experience is that you get to round 7 and everyone has an infinite pot of money that they have a lack of things to do with. Or they have absolutely no resources and it's a real struggle and Control has to find a way around that. But in this game, I found the resource tuning and the balancing was really, really positive. And like one of the best examples of that I heard after the game was back to that example of FSI trying to take the spaceport in Crysis on the map. You both have to pay money to get a unit and you have to pay money for the unit to be able to do anything. And I know that a number of the rounds that FSI was holding that spaceport, they would be spending all their money buying units and they'd have no money left over to use their units. Mm-hmm. So it was purely just a bluff show of force. But that bluff was so tense for them as players because of the tightness of the resource economy in the game. So that kind of small numbers, addition only, no multiplication, really like well-tuned resource economy, I think really supported a lot of the operational art nature of this game.
I definitely agree with that. It felt very balanced at the map in that I always had, every turn I felt like I was getting more resources, but I never had quite enough to do the cool things I wanted to. And that feels like a very good progressive path through the game.
That's fantastic. Yeah. So what do you think was the secret? What made this economy work so well when it is so typically, so often goes completely out of whack?
I think from my point of view, there's two secrets. The first is that the overall pot of money has a hard constraint. So the maps are divided into like zones, wards, and each ward gives you a certain fixed value of support, which is kind of like money in Crysis. And that fixed total pie nature that doesn't really grow meant that your growth in resources was purely driven by your competition with others. So it was very, very difficult to successfully grow and turtle at the same time. And then secondly, I think the other really key thing that I think a lot of people miss about resource design is this game, all the numbers are small. Like the most valuable ward gave you about 6 support. And at maximum, the like greatest number of resources that were earned by any team in any round was about 20, 24, something like that, which is quite a small number in the context of a lot of mega games that I've played. And I think keeping the numbers small really created a lot of tension around how they were used, and in particular, remove the ability for problematic variants where if you have very large numbers, you can end up with very large variations in a way that can sometimes be very good and sometimes just swing completely in the realm of everyone has too much.
And Melbourne Mega Games are running Crysis again in January, but just running around the grounds, would you personally run or play in it again yourself? Starting with Patrick, I think.
Well, I'm not going to play again in January, mostly just because it's quite a way to go and flights were quite expensive this term. But that was on me. I made the decision quite last minute. I think I wouldn't mind playing it again. I am quite interested to see how you could tweak some things in it. So it sounds like that's not on the table this time. So I'm a maybe, I think. I'd be interested to see behind the curtain maybe and see how Control runs it for sure.
Awesome. And Jeff, would you play again? And also with this being your first mega game, what are your future plans in terms of things you're interested in playing in future?
Oh, I'm totally hooked. Like, I'm definitely playing again. I'm going to play again in January. I've already got a team of 6 people. recruited all my friends into it. It's going to be great. I'm even looking at the ones in other states to have another go somewhere else. It's just a unique experience. I think I'm going to have I'm going to do a lot this year.
Good to hear.
Well, from a Goldman Gambus point of view, we are running it again in January. It's almost fully sold out, which is super great. We generally run 2 to 3 games a year. I am actually ditching Control and playing. Along with some other members of Control, my other faction Control peer Jake and Tristan, who is one of the game Control, we've formed a team of 5 or 6 people, which should be quite fun. We don't get to play games super often. We spend most of our time organizing them. So I'm looking forward to being able to do shenanigans.
You have to cherish that, and because it won't happen again for many years.
Yeah.
I feel like it'll also be like that tabletop game scenario where the game master finally gets to play and they just really cause trouble because they're just getting it all out of their system.
I am also a forever GM, and that is exactly what I do whenever I get to play.
Yep.
Awesome. Fantastic. All right. I think that brings us to the close of the show. I just want to shout out again, Alex Beck, the designer of this game. I believe the best place to find his work or get into contact with him is Horizon Mega Games at horizonmegagames.com. Let's go around the grounds. Patrick, is there anything you wanted to mention as we wrap up or any plugs you wanted to make?
Yeah, I suppose I just wanted to thank the Melbourne gang for putting this on. They have beaten us to the mark every time out of COVID, and it was really awesome to come down and play. Looking forward to being down there again and also hopefully seeing some of the crowd come up to Sydney sometime soon. So huge thanks to them for putting it on. Thanks to Alex for making the game and making it available. And thanks to Jeff and Leon for joining us, of course.
Oh, yeah, I'm just super grateful to everyone around the game. Yeah, thank you very much. I had a great day. I'm just stoked you guys are doing all this hard work, and I plan to do none of it and enjoy all the benefits.
At least he's honest.
I can't not thank Jeff for his amazing closing speech on game day. Jeff, we got one person from every team to come up and give a closing speech, and Jeff came up with this like 5-minute brilliant monologue in character that just blew the whole room away. So huge shout out to you, but also to all of the new players who came to play Crisis. One of the really nice things that we're seeing as well with Mega Games is that most of the games that we've run in the last year and a half, about half the players have been new to Mega Games entirely. So hopefully we can keep growing and keep putting on a fun show.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. So good to see in-person Mega Games getting back into the swing of things after COVID and ourselves getting back into it. It's absolutely awesome. With that, I think all that's left is for us to close out and just say thank you so much, all of you, for joining in on the podcast, and best of luck with the next run in January.